The chandeliers of Ashworth House spilled honeyed light over 300 guests, yet Lady Alina Ashby felt only the chill of a gilded cage tightening around her ribs. She stood beside her betrothed, Alexander Montfort, the Duke of Ashworth, as he greeted his guests with the mechanical charm of a man performing a duty. The sapphire on her left hand, the Ashworth heirloom, caught the light and threw blue sparks onto the ivory silk of her gown. It was a magnificent stone, cold and heavy as a promise she had begun to doubt the moment she accepted it. Across the ballroom, Madame Celeste Morrow laughed at some whispered remark from Lord Halstead, her dark curls arranged in glossy perfection. She wore crimson, a bold choice for an unmarried widow, and she wore it without apology. Alina had noticed the Duke's gaze drift toward that crimson figure no fewer than four times in the last quarter hour. Each time, his attention snapped back to Alina with a bland smile, but the damage was done. "You seem distracted, Your Grace," Alina said, her voice soft enough that only he could hear. "A host's duty," he replied, not meeting her eyes. "One must circulate." "You circulate, rather fixedly, toward the West Alcove." His jaw tightened. "You imagine things, Lady Alina. It is unbecoming." The rebuke was as gentle as a slap. She held her tongue, but her gloved fingers curled against her palm. She had entered this engagement with clear eyes. Her father needed the alliance. The Duke needed an heir and an unimpeachable bride. But she had believed, perhaps naively, that mutual respect might grow. Instead, she felt herself being measured against a silhouette in crimson and found wanting. Later, when the dancing began, the Duke led Alina through a first waltz with flawless formality. He held her at the precise distance decorum demanded, his hand light at her waist, his conversation limited to remarks about the weather and the crush of carriages outside. Then the dance ended, and he excused himself to speak with his steward about some estate matter. Alina watched him cross the room and stop, not at the steward's side, but before Madame Celeste. The next waltz began, and the Duke took the widow's hand. They moved across the floor with a familiarity that whispered of many private hours. Alina stood at the edge of the ballroom, her mother's anxious chatter a distant hum. Lady Grantham prattled about wedding flowers and the bishop's availability, but Alina heard only the Dowager Lady Sefton's voice behind her, pitched to Carrie. "It is the way of these great houses, my dear. The wife is for heirs, the mistress for pleasure. One simply looks the other way." Alina did not look away. She watched the Duke's head incline toward Celeste as they turned, watched the widow's gloved fingers linger on his shoulder. Something inside her, a resilient core she had not known she possessed, began to calcify. When the dance ended and the Duke returned to her side, faintly flushed and smelling of orange blossom perfume that was not her own, she spoke again. "That perfume is rather distinctive, Your Grace. I trust your steward enjoyed it." His eyes frosted. "I will not be interrogated at my own ball." "No interrogation," she said. "Only an observation. A duchess is supposed to observe, is she not? To manage the household, to smooth over appearances. I am learning my role." He studied her, perhaps sensing a shift beneath her calm surface. "See that you do," he said, and offered his arm. "It is time for supper." Alina placed her hand on his sleeve and let him lead her toward the dining room, where crystal and silver glittered under more chandeliers. She ate the courses placed before her, answered the pleasantries directed at her, and smiled until her face ached. All the while, the sapphire burned against her finger like a brand. That night in her room at her father's house, she stood before the mirror and examined the ring. It was beautiful beyond measure, centuries old, a treasure meant to bind her to a legacy of cold glances and silent humiliations. She twisted it off her finger and held it in her palm, the metal still warm from her skin. She did not know yet what she would do, but she knew, with a certainty that steadied her breathing, that she would not become invisible in her own marriage. She would not be a portrait on a wall while another woman warmed the Duke's private hours. Tomorrow there was to be another grand event, the Duchess of Richmond's soiree. the entire ton would attend, and Alina Ashby intended to be more than an ornament. She slipped the ring back on, but looser now, ready to be shed. Part 2, The Ring and the Ruin. Richmond House blazed with wax candles and the murmur of 600 voices. The Duchess of Richmond's soiree was the pinnacle of the little season, and no one who mattered would dare be absent. Alina entered on her father's arm, her gown the color of deep amber, her hair dressed simply without the fuss of plumes or overbright jewels. The sapphire ring remained on her hand, but it felt lighter, as though the stone itself awaited her decision. The Duke of Ashworth found her within the first hour, pressing a perfunctory kiss to her gloved knuckles. "You look well," he said, his tone already absent. "You are too kind." Alina inclined her head. "Will you be dancing with your steward again this evening, or does he not attend soirees?" The barb landed. The Duke's nostrils flared slightly, but before he could reply, a ripple of attention drew every gaze toward the arched entrance. Madame Celeste Morrow descended the shallow steps in a gown of silver tissue that clung to her form like water. She wore diamonds at her throat and ears, diamonds that whispered of a patron's generosity. The Duke's attention veered toward her, and Alina felt the last thread of her patience snap. For the next hour, she observed. The Duke did not openly parade Celeste, but he found reasons to stand near her, to exchange remarks that made the widow laugh behind her fan. The ton noticed. Glances flew like arrows. Lady Jersey raised an eyebrow. Lord Alvanley murmured a quip behind his hand. Alina felt the weight of pity and amusement pressing on her from all sides. The moment came during the interval, when guests drifted toward the card room and the refreshment salon. The Duke stood near a marble column, Celeste at his side, her hand resting on his forearm as though she had every right. A small group clustered around them, Lord Halstead, Lady Cowper, Sir Henry Milford, all listening to the widow recount some witty Parisian anecdote. The Duke smiled down at her with a warmth Alina had never seen directed at herself. Alina crossed the floor alone. The crowd parted, not with overt drama but with the subtle instinct of a ton that sensed a reckoning. Her skirts rustled over the parquet, and the sound seemed to quiet the nearby chatter. "Your Grace," her voice cut through the anecdote, clear and unhurried. The Duke turned, and something flickered in his expression. Annoyance, perhaps, or a warning. Celeste's hand remained on his arm, a deliberate provocation. Her dark eyes assessed Alina with the lazy confidence of a woman who believed she had already won. "Lady Alina," the Duke began, "we were just." "I know precisely what you were doing." Alina's tone carried no heat. She lifted her left hand and the sapphire captured the light, throwing blue fire across Celeste's silver gown. With deliberate slowness, she worked the ring from her finger. It came free with a faint tug, leaving a pale band of skin beneath. The Duke's face lost its careful neutrality. "What are you doing?" Alina held the ring between thumb and forefinger, letting the assembly see it. The chatter around them died in stages, like candles being snuffed. She looked at Celeste, not at him. "You have wanted his attention, his gifts, his favor," she said. "Take this as well. It is the symbol of a bond I no longer recognize." She did not throw it with violence. She tossed it underhand, a gentle arc, and the ring landed against the widow's bodice before dropping into her startled palm. Celeste caught it by reflex, her mouth opening in shock. "Keep him," Alina said. The words landed like a pistol shot in the silence. Somewhere, a woman gasped. A footman froze with a tray of champagne glasses. The Duke of Ashworth, master of 10,000 acres and a lineage stretching to the Plantagenets, stood immobilized. Then his control shattered. "Alina," his voice cracked through the room, stripped of all polish. He lurched forward, knocking against Lord Halstead, who stumbled aside. "You will not, this is absurd, come back here." Alina had already turned. She walked toward the grand staircase, her back straight, her pace unhurried. Behind her, she heard the Duke's footsteps, heavy and unsteady on the parquet, and the urgent murmur of 100 voices, rising like a tide. "Alina, stop, I command you to stop. She did not stop. She did not look back. At the top of the stairs, she allowed a footman to place her cloak around her shoulders and walked out into the cool London night, where her carriage waited. The Duke reached the entrance just as her coach pulled away, and those who watched from the windows saw him stand on the portico, fists clenched, his chest heaving with a fury that bordered on anguish. The Duke of Ashworth, who had never lost a thing in his life, had lost control before everyone's eyes. Part 3. The Price of Dignity. The scandal unfurled across London with the speed of ink on gossip sheets. By noon the next day, every drawing room from Mayfair to St. James's hummed with variations of the scene. Some accounts had Lady Alina dashing the ring at the widow's feet. Others claimed she had struck Madame Celeste across the face. A few, the more accurate, described the quiet dignity of her exit and the Duke's subsequent unraveling, how he had stood on Richmond House's portico, shouting her name into the darkness while footmen scrambled and dowagers clutched their fans. At Grantham House, the atmosphere was less poetic. The Earl paced the library carpet, his face mottled with fury. "Do you comprehend what you have done? The alliance, the settlements gone. You have made us a laughingstock." Alina sat in a wingback chair, still in her amber gown from the night before, a shawl around her shoulders. She had not slept. "I have made myself free, Papa. There is a difference." Her mother wept into a handkerchief, punctuating the tears with lamentations about ruined seasons and unwed daughters. Alina listened without flinching. She had anticipated this storm and anchored herself against it. The sapphire ring was gone. She did not know or care what Celeste had done with it, and with it, the weight of a future she could not endure. The Duke's first letter arrived before breakfast, carried by a liveried footman. It was sealed with the Ashworth crest, the wax still warm. Alina broke it open, scanned the furious, pleading lines, and placed it on the mantel. "You will return to me. This is not concluded. I demand an audience." She wrote no reply. A second letter followed by midday, this one less commanding and more bewildered. "I did not think you capable of such a scene. If I have offended you, let us speak privately. There is no need for this public severance." She placed it beside the first. The third letter came as dusk gathered. The handwriting was uneven, blotted in places. "Alina, please." She placed it with the others, but her fingers lingered on the paper a moment longer. By week's end, she had withdrawn to her Aunt Honoria's house in Bath, a honeystone terrace overlooking the pump room. The journey west gave her time to think, and the distance from London allowed the clamor to fade into a manageable hum. Aunt Honoria, a widow of independent means and sharp opinions, received her with dry sherry and a single remark. "I always said Ashworth had the emotional constitution of a spoiled pony. You are well rid of him." Alina walked the crescents and read books and spoke little of London. She received no more letters from the Duke, but news filtered through Aunt Honoria's correspondence. The Duke, it seemed, had abruptly severed all public association with Madame Celeste. The widow had been seen leaving Ashworth House in a hired carriage, her expression furious. Speculation swirled that he had paid her a substantial settlement to vanish. And still the Duke did not come to Bath. Alina told herself she was relieved. One afternoon in the pump room she caught a snippet of conversation between two elderly matrons. "They say Ashworth has become a recluse, refuses all invitations. Lady Jersey is beside herself." Her companion nodded sagely. "A man who loses a bride in such a fashion either learns something or learns nothing. Time will tell." Alina sipped her water and felt a small, quiet ache that she did not wish to name. She had walked away, and she would do it again. But she had not anticipated that the Duke's loss of control, witnessed by so many, might also be the first honest emotion he had ever shown her. Part 4. A Different Kind of Man. Bath in early autumn wore a mantle of soft mist and pale sunshine. The pump room filled each morning with the genteel hum of conversation and the discreet clink of glasses of mineral water. Eleanor took her walks along the Royal Crescent, Aunt Honoria's arm linked through hers, and slowly the tautness in her shoulders began to ease. It was at one of Lady Parkhurst's quiet card parties that she first encountered Lord William Thornhill, the Marquis of Thornhill. He was not the sort of man who commanded a room upon entering. He stood by the window with a cup of tea, listening to an elderly colonel describe the peninsular campaign with genuine attention. When introduced to Eleanor, he did not make a practice compliment. He simply said, "I have heard you are newly arrived. Bath agrees with those who seek peace." She liked him for that, the absence of effusive flattery. He was some years past 30, with a face that had seen weather and a calmness that seemed intrinsic. His estate lay near the Cotswolds, and he spoke of it with the quiet pride of a man who cared more for yields than for town gossip. Over the following weeks, he called at Aunt Honoria's house with proper formality. He escorted Eleanor and her aunt to the Theatre Royal. He partnered Eleanor at whist and did not condescend when she played poorly. He asked her opinions on enclosure acts and the education of tenant children, and then listened to her answers. She found herself laughing at his dry observations about Bath society and felt no need to guard her words. One afternoon, walking along the Kennet and Avon Canal, he said, "I have heard what happened in London. I will not pretend otherwise, but I am not a man who judges a woman for refusing a bad bargain." Eleanor studied the towpath. "The bargain was expected of me. I simply realized I could not honor it." "The Duke's loss," Lord William said, "is not a thing I will publicly criticize, but I will privately think it." She smiled, and it felt natural. News of the Marquess's attentions reached London, as all news did. The Duke of Ashworth, cloistered in his library with ledgers and brandy, heard it from his secretary with a tightening of his jaw that presaged a storm. He had spent weeks in a strange internal exile, canceling engagements, ignoring invitations, replaying the scene at Richmond House until the memory felt like a blade he could not dislodge. He had let Celeste go with a cold finality, her protests withering under the single phrase, "Leave England." She had obeyed, but not before warning him he would regret casting her aside. He did not regret it. The regret that gnawed at him was older and sharper, the recognition that he had treated Eleanor Ashby as an acquisition, not a woman, and that she had seen through him with a clarity that shamed him. Within a week he arrived in Bath, taking rooms at the White Hart. He sent a note to Eleanor, requesting a meeting. She read it in the morning room, her expression unreadable. "You need not see him," Aunt Honoria said. "Burn it." But Eleanor had a different instinct. She would not hide. She replied with a single line, "The pump room, tomorrow at 11. She chose the setting deliberately, public, neutral, impossible for a scene. The Duke arrived early, standing near the King's pump, and when she entered on Lord William's arm, his composure flickered. The Marquess, with perfect tact, excused himself to speak with an acquaintance, leaving Eleanor to face her former betrothed alone. The Duke looked diminished. The arrogant tilt of his head was gone, replaced by a tension in his shoulders. "You are well," he asked. "I am. What do you wish to say, Your Grace?" "I behaved abominably." The words came out stiffly, as though he had rehearsed them and yet found them inadequate. "At the ball and before, I did not respect you. I did not see, I did not allow myself to see, what I was risking." Eleanor watched him, her hands folded. "And what were you risking?" "You," his voice roughened. "I have no clever speech. I only know that since you walked out, I have felt as though a door closed that I cannot open again." She let the silence stretch. The pump room chattered around them. "You felt entitled to my presence and my tolerance. You mistook my composure for compliance. I will never be compliant again, Your Grace. Not for you, not for any man." "I am not asking for compliance." "What are you asking for?" He hesitated. "A chance." Eleanor's gaze did not waver. "You had a chance. You threw it away before I ever threw that ring. I have no more chances to give you." She turned and walked toward Lord William. who was waiting with a quiet patience that spoke of a different kind of strength. The Duke remained by the pump, his hands at his sides, his face a mask of controlled anguish. And this time when she walked away, he did not call out. He simply watched her go, and the weight of her absence settled over him like a verdict. Part 5, The Cost of Pride. The Duke returned to Ashworth House a different man, though such transformations, Aliener knew, were often temporary masks for pride. She had seen contrition before among the ton. It usually lasted until the next temptation. She returned to her life in Bath, to Lord William's gentle courtship and Aunt Honoria's bracing wisdom, and she did not allow herself to dwell on the Duke's tired eyes or the way his voice had cracked on the word chance. In London, however, something more tectonic was shifting. The Duke of Ashworth, in a move that stunned society, published a notice in the Morning Post. It was not a dual announcement nor a political screed, but a personal statement of uncommon frankness. The Duke of Ashworth wishes it known that recent public displays at the Duchess of Richmond's soiree were the consequence of his own dishonorable conduct. He regrets any mortification caused to Lady Aliener Ashby and acknowledges that her actions were both justified and dignified. No further speculation regarding Madame Celeste Morrow will be entertained. The statement sent ripples through every club and drawing room. A duke confessing fault in print was almost unheard of. The dowagers murmured that it was unseemly. The younger set found it romantic. Lord Alvanley remarked that Ashworth had finally discovered a spine, though unfortunately it was a public one. Celeste Morrow, still lingering in a hired house in Dover while she arranged passage to the continent, read the notice with cold fury. The duke had paid her handsomely to disappear, but money did not salve wounded pride. She had been discarded, and now he was humiliating her anew by painting himself as a penitent and Aliener as a paragon. She began to draft letters, letters that hinted at improprieties, at secret meetings, at a correspondence between Aliener and a nameless admirer. She had no proof, but proof could be manufactured. Ink and a steady hand were all she needed. Meanwhile, the Duke sat in his library and composed a letter of his own, this one private, addressed to Aliener in Bath. It ran to 12 pages. He wrote about his father, a cold man who had taught him that emotion was weakness. He wrote about his fear of attachment, his habit of keeping lovers at a safe distance. He wrote that he had seen Celeste as a buffer, a way to avoid the terrifying vulnerability of a real marriage. And he wrote that he loved Aliener, not as a possession, not as a duchess, but as the woman who had shown him his own reflection and walked away rather than accept a lesser version of him. He sealed the letter and sent it by express courier, then sat in the darkening library and waited. Aliener received it 3 days later. She read it in her room, the window open to the Bath sky. She read it twice. Then she folded it carefully and placed it in her writing desk. She did not discuss it with Aunt Honoria. She did not mention it to Lord William. But she did not burn it. A week afterward, the first of Celeste's forged letters began to circulate. They purported to be from Aliener to a mysterious gentleman, expressing more than friendship. The handwriting was a passable imitation, and the salaciousness was perfectly calibrated to shock. The gossip network seized on them with gleeful speed. Lord William's family sent an urgent note suggesting he return to Thornhill and reconsider his association with a lady under such a cloud. He did not leave, but Aliener saw the strain in his face. The Duke of Ashworth saw the letters and recognized the hand behind them. He had saved samples of Celeste's writing from her tenure as his mistress, notes, receipts, a few billets doux he had never bothered to destroy. He brought them to a graphologist, who confirmed what he already knew. The circulated letters were forgeries. He did not hesitate. He sent word to Lady Jersey and to the editor of the Morning Post, offering proof. And then he did something that set the ton entirely on its ear. He traveled to Bath, walked into the pump room at the height of the morning crush, and publicly addressed the assembled company. The letters currently attributed to Lady Aliener Ashby are fabrications, created by a woman of no honor whom I was foolish enough to countenance. I have evidence of their forgery, which I will make available to any person of consequence who wishes to examine it. Lady Aliner's character is untarnished. The stain is mine, and mine alone." He spoke without theatricality, his voice carrying to every corner. Aliner, standing near the colonnade with Lord William, felt the room's attention swing toward her. She saw the Duke's eyes find hers across the crowd, and there was no demand in them, only a question he did not voice aloud. Lord William, beside her, let out a quiet breath. "That was a costly declaration," he murmured. "He has put his own reputation on the block for your sake." Aliner said nothing, but she did not look away from the Duke, and after a long moment she gave the faintest nod, an acknowledgement, not a promise. Part 6, The Mistress's Revenge and the Duke's Defense. The forged letters withered under scrutiny. The Duke's evidence, Celeste's original handwriting samples, the testimony of the graphologist, and the quiet corroboration of a Dover innkeeper who had seen her drafting documents late into the night, erased any lingering doubt. Lady Jersey declared the matter closed, which in the ton meant the subject was now merely whispered rather than trumpeted. Celeste, facing potential legal action, boarded a packet ship for Calais and did not look back. But the damage had been done, and the cost was not just to Aliner's reputation. Lord William Thornhill received a formal visit from his uncle, the Earl of Marchester, who made it abundantly clear that the family would not countenance a marriage to a woman embroiled in such notoriety, innocent or not. "It is not about truth," the Earl said in Lord William's rented bath drawing room. "It is about the appearance of scandal. A marquis cannot marry a cloud." Aliner released Lord William from any understanding before he could stumble through the words himself. They walked in Sydney Gardens, the autumn leaves crunching underfoot, and she said, "You have been a true friend. I will not let your family fracture over me. Go home, William. Mend fences." He argued because he was an honorable man, but there was relief beneath his protest, and she saw it. She sent him away with a smile and a grateful heart, and when she was alone on the gravel path, she allowed herself to sit on a bench and feel the weight of the previous month settle over her. The Duke did not descend upon her. He remained in Bath, staying at the White Hart, but he did not call at Aunt Honoria's house. He did not send notes. He simply existed at the periphery of her world, a tall figure glimpsed at the edge of the pump room or walking the crescent, never approaching. It was as though he had finally learned the discipline of waiting. 3 days after Lord William's departure, Aliner sent a note to the White Hart. It contained no greeting, only an instruction: the canal bridge at sunset. He was there before her, standing with his hands clasped behind his back, his greatcoat buttoned against the chill. The water reflected the amber and rose of the sky, and the towpath was quiet. She approached alone. "You defended me," she said, stopping a few feet away, "at considerable cost to yourself." "I did what I should have done months ago." His voice was hoarse, as though he had not used it much. "The cost does not matter." "It matters to me." She pulled her shawl tighter. "I told you I had no more chances to give. That was true at the time, but you have not asked for one since." "I will not ask now. I have no right." They stood in the deepening dusk. A barge passed slowly, its lantern swinging. "I kept your letter," she said. "The one you wrote from the library. I did not burn it." He turned his head to look at her, and the hope in his face was so raw that she felt it like a physical pressure. He mastered it after a moment, tucking it behind his usual reserve, but she had seen. "I am not the woman who threw that ring," she continued. She was desperate to prove she would not be erased. "I no longer need to prove anything. So if I tell you something now, it is not from desperation. It is from choice." "Tell me," he said, barely above a whisper. "I noticed," she said, "when you stood in the pump room and took the shame onto yourself. I noticed when you did not pursue me here. I noticed when you let William court me without interference, even though I know it cost you. I have been noticing, Alexander." His name, spoken without a title, seemed to undo something in him. He drew a breath that shook. "I do not have the sapphire ring," she went on. "I never want to see it again. But if you wish to offer me something else, something that carries no obligation and no expectation, I will consider it." For a long moment, he could not speak. Then he reached into the inner pocket of his greatcoat and withdrew a small box. It was not velvet, but plain polished wood, the sort a country jeweler might use. He opened it and held it out to her. Inside, on a bed of cream silk, lay a simple gold band. It was old, the metal softly burnished, engraved inside with a date, 1764, and a pair of initials she did not recognize. "It was my mother," he said. "She wore it every day of her marriage. My father gave it to her the morning after their wedding, after the grand ceremony was over and the crowds had gone. He said the public ring was for show, but this one was for the life they would build. I never offered it to anyone. I did not think I would ever. I did not think I deserved to." Eleanor looked at the band, then at him. The Duke of Ashworth, who had lost his composure before the entire ton, who had published his own humiliation and chased a fraud out of England, stood on a canal bridge with the fatting son behind him and held out the most unassuming ring she had ever seen. She did not take it, not yet. "Walk with me," she said. "We have a great deal to discuss." And he walked, falling into step beside her as if it were the most natural thing in the world. Part 7, A Token Earned. They married in a country church in Derbyshire, a small stone building surrounded by yews and winterbear fields. The banns had been read quietly 3 weeks prior, and the guest list numbered fewer than 20, Aunt Honoria, a handful of the Duke's more discreet relatives, and two of Eleanor's school friends who had never wavered in their loyalty. The Earl of Grantham attended but refused to speak. His wife wept, though this time the tears seemed less bitter. The ton was not invited, and the absence of London's great name spoke louder than any sermon. Eleanor wore dove-gray silk, not white, and carried a posy of winter roses. The vicar, an elderly man who had baptized the Duke 3 decades earlier, intoned the words with a tremor of sincere feeling. When the Duke slipped the simple gold band onto Eleanor's finger, his hand was steady. She looked at it, resting above her knuckle, and felt the quiet weight of a promise she had chosen. The wedding breakfast at a nearby inn was a subdued affair, but the air held a tentative warmth. The Duke made a brief speech, devoid of grandiosity, thanking those present and ending with, "I have been granted far more than I merit. I intend to spend my life proving myself worthy." Aunt Honoria sniffed loudly and muttered, "About time," which broke the tension and drew a ripple of laughter. When the last carriage had departed and the inn's parlor fell quiet, the Duke and Duchess of Ashworth, a title Eleanor still found strange on her own shoulders, walked together along a hedgerow path that bordered the churchyard. The afternoon was gray and still, the kind of weather that pressed close like a held breath. "I have a confession," the Duke said after a long silence. "When you threw that ring, I was not angry at you, not truly. I was terrified." Eleanor glanced at him, terrified of what? "That I had finally met someone who saw through every defense I had, and I had already lost her." He stopped walking and faced her. "I thought I could keep you at a distance and still possess you. I was a fool." "Yes," she agreed, but her tone was gentle. "You were." He accepted the word without flinching. "And now?" "Now you are a man who has learned that possession is not love." She reached up and straightened the lapel of his coat, a small, wifely gesture that felt monumental. "I do not need you to be perfect, Alexander. I need you to be honest. Can you do that?" "I can try," he said, "every day." She nodded, "Then I will too." They did not return to London for another month. Instead, they traveled to Ashworth's primary estate, a sprawling manor in the Cotswolds that had stood since the 14th century. Eleanor walked through rooms she would now manage, met tenants whose names she wrote in a small ledger, and gradually began to feel that this life was hers, not one she had been slotted into. When they finally made their appearance at a London ball, Lady Jersey, because of course it was, the ton held its collective breath. Elena entered on the Duke's arm, wearing sapphire blue silk that matched no known heirloom. The simple gold band on her finger gleamed in the chandelier light. She did not look at the faces turned toward her. She looked at her husband, who was looking at her with an attention so focused that it made the dowagers fan themselves. They danced. The steps were not flawless. He stepped on her hem once and she laughed aloud, a sound that carried across the floor. It was the laugh that undid the onlookers. The Duke of Ashworth had been seen contrite, humbled, furious, and broken. He had never been seen making his wife laugh in the middle of a crowded ballroom. Later, when the supper room had thinned and the candles guttered low, Elena stood by a window and watched the carriages assemble. The Duke joined her, offering a glass of champagne. "Do you remember the last soiree we attended together?" she asked. "Every detail," he said. "I will remember it for the rest of my life." "As will I, but not with regret. That night I found myself. I would not trade that even for an easier path." He set down his glass. "I would spare you the pain if I could." "The pain was the price. I paid it willingly." She turned to him and her expression was luminous without being fragile. "You have paid your own price. We are square, I think." "Then let us be done with accounts," he said, and took her hand. The gold band was warm against his palm. "From this night forward, we build something new." Outside, the London night was dark and glittering, full of carriages and whispers that no longer mattered. Inside, a duke who had once lost everything in a single moment stood with the woman who had walked away, and neither of them looked toward the door. She had not kept him, she had chosen him. And that, Elena thought, made all the difference.